There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. In today's episode in our series on the history of bad ideas, I'm talking to the podcaster and political economist Helen Thomson about the gold standard, which was the linchpin of the global economy until it all fell apart in war and political chaos. I'm going to be asking Helen what the gold standard was, why people believed in it, how it was meant to work, why it didn't work, and why some people believe in it even now. Helen, full disclosure, when I asked you to talk about the gold standard, I was assuming it was a bad idea because, for reasons we'll discuss, some bad things happened during the era, the heyday of the gold standard. And you said you were happy to do it, but you're not completely convinced that it's a bad idea. So we need to explore that. And clearly, it's something that many people have believed in and had an awful lot of confidence in. And even to this day, there are people who hanker for it. So it's one of those bad ideas that's not obviously always bad. Before we get onto that, and I know it's complicated, but can you just give a brief summary of how it was meant to work in its heyday? Its heyday, the late 19th, early 20th century. This is the organizing principle of international finance and international trade based on gold. How does it work when gold is the basis of international trade?
Well, the fundamental idea is that money is backed by gold, and that in any individual country that's on the gold standard, that banknotes that are issued are convertible into gold at a fixed rate. So if you then think about that in international terms, it means that you can work out bilateral exchange rates, so exchange rates between two different countries on the basis of what each of them has fixed their, if you like, national price of gold at. And you've got then, at least de facto, an international currency for those states that are participating in the system. And so you have a basis on which you can conduct international trade with not having to worry about how to transfer money and deal with balance of payments differences between different states, because gold should be the glue that holds the world economy. We should be clear that not all states participated in the gold standard together.
So it's the glue, and therefore its appeal is it gives you stability or predictability. So we live in a world of, broadly speaking, floating exchange rates. So these currencies and their value relative to each other changes a lot. It can be unpredictable. Is the appeal of the gold standard, or should I say, was the appeal of the gold standard in its heyday, that here's a global currency that allows states in an era where people were thinking of trade as a global phenomenon to interact with each other in a reliable, predictable, stable way? Is that its appeal?
In a way it is, but I think you can't separate out that from the preceding history, because it's not the first time that a metal had been used as an effective international currency. So that you can take the period from the 16th century, maybe even the beginning of the 15th century, through to the first part of the 19th century and say that silver was doing the same thing. Now, it didn't work in quite the same way in which having gold standard trade did, but it did facilitate much more trade between different parts of the world than had been the case prior to the internationalization of silver, if we can call it that. And interestingly, China was at the center of it, in the sense that China was the place where a lot of the silver went in this trading system, because China moved from having a fiat currency to having a silver currency and didn't have silver mines in order to support that. And the other side of that was Spanish imperial power, control in South America, particularly Mexico, Peru, Bolivia, and that's where the silver was coming from. So if you then put together the weakening of China through the first third of the 19th century, certainly by the 1840s, and the end of Spanish imperial power, Mexican independence, 1821, then the old system had broken down. Now, you could say that there wasn't stability in the same way. There's nothing that's like the Bank of England as acting as a central bank when you're talking about Spain. And the thing about the gold standard from the 1870s was that it was much more a central bank driven system than the silver standard or the silver trade standard had been. But I think that you can't say that this was the first time that a metal had been used to create an international currency system.
One of the puzzles for me about the gold standard is the politics of it, because by the time we're talking about its peak, its heyday, from the 1870s onwards through to the First World War, a lot of politics in the United States, in Europe, is a kind of battle between gold and silver. So what you've just described is there was an international trading system based on silver, which operated not quite in the same way as the gold standard, but it allowed for certain kinds of exchange and at least certain kinds of stability without central banks underpinning it. But by the time you get to, say, the 1890s, the great populist wave in America, silver has come to symbolize the people. It's come to symbolize politics trying to tear down the elites, taking on the banks, taking on Wall Street. It's the great cry of the democratic reformers, back to silver. Gold has come to symbolize elite politics. It's come to symbolize a certain kind of distance from the people. For some people, it's anti-democratic politics. I've never really understood this. I don't know how much it has to do with gold being rarer than silver or having a different kind of symbolism. Critics of the gold standard, I think, believe people fetishize gold. They give it a kind of magical quality. How did we get to a world then where silver versus gold becomes proxy for the people versus the elites?
This is both a really complicated question, but it's actually an absolutely fascinating question, because I think that it's got a long prehistory. Yet at the same time, the events lead up to the emergence of the gold standard bring something completely else to the table. So if we go back to the really long history and go back to late medieval, early modern Europe, you have monetary systems in which there is, domestically I mean by this, both gold and silver. And by the point of, certainly by the 16th century, you have the idea that gold is the currency for large payments, and that a bit comes out of the Italian city republics, and silver is for smaller payments. And this quite easily lends itself, I think, to the idea that gold is the currency of the crowns and that silver is a more ordinary currency. And you can see that, to take an example from Shakespeare in Merchant of Venice, when Bassanio has got those three boxes to choose from, gold, silver, and lead. He describes them, I'm going to mangle this, I know, but I think he describes silver as pale and common tawdry between man and man, but gold is gaudy, hard food for Midas, meaning the king Midas from Greek mythology, whom everything he touches turns to gold. So that's there, that thing that you're talking about in 1890s America, in a way is being articulated by Shakespeare at that point. But if you then go to the two decades preceding the gold standard, what you can see is that actually there are these new gold discoveries, not least in California, but also in Australia. And then there's this period in which there's not much going on in terms of new silver mining. There's more gold than there is silver. So actually, the reason why, or one of the reasons why, it becomes quite difficult for the French, who are the ones who are basically trying to maintain bimetallism in the 1860s and the early 1870s, is because there isn't really enough silver in order to do that. And so even before the Franco-Prussian War, which is a big deal in this story, Louis Napoleon is basically saying we might need to move to gold, because there just isn't really enough silver to maintain the French position. It's then kind of forced on the French because the Germans, in winning the Franco-Prussian War and occupying Paris, basically take the indemnity that they forced France to pay and use it to move the new German state to gold.
So for me, that's kind of, I never knew that. And I'd always assumed that the appeal of the gold standard for the people who believe in it is that gold, uniquely among the possible metallic bases of money, is rare. I mean, it just is the rarest of these. It's very hard to mine it and extract it. There are gold rushes, but it's extracted at a relatively steady rate. So you don't get a sudden massive expansion of gold. And I just assumed silver was the cause of the people because there's more silver in the world. And therefore, money can be more flexible when it's based on silver because the amount goes up and down. And gold is this kind of rigid constraint because it's so hard to produce. And like I said, for the people who think that the advocates of the gold standard fetishize gold, there's also a sense that those people think that anything else is alchemy. You know, like you just can't conjure gold. I know you can't conjure silver out of thin air either, but you can't conjure gold out of thin air. So any attempt to make money anything else is a sort of alchemy, and gold is the absolute bedrock certainty or security. But it sounds like the gold standard emerged because there was more of it.
In that period, I think that there's no doubt that those gold discoveries in the middle of the 19th century are a pretty big part of the story of shifting to gold. I think if you look at the arguments that were made by the bimetallists, so the people who wanted both gold and silver to continue, their argument tended to be that, look, these resources fluctuate in terms of the volume in which that they're extracted. So why not have a system that balances out the cycles of mining, if you like, so that at any time when there's less gold being or new gold being mined, there may be more new silver being mined. And that as long as you keep the price between the two of them, as long as you manage that, that this is a better system because it will allow there for to be more money in the world than if you rely on one or the other. The other thing that's interesting, if we then switch to the United States, is that the politics of silver versus gold or silver and gold begins really in 1873, what gets called by the critics the crime of 1873, which is the beginnings really of the United States moving to the gold standard, though it's not actually implemented in terms of convertibility until 1879. You look at the coalition in the 1870s that's talking about the crime of 1873, it isn't just the people who are going to end up voting for William Jennings Bryan in 1896, it's the silver miners. And they get a big boost in the middle of the 1870s because more silver is found in the United States and mined. And that makes the politics of it pretty interesting when you, by the time you get to 1896, because not only do you have the populist party candidate, Bryan, being the Democratic Party candidate, you have this body of people called the Silver Republicans who support Bryan in 1896, but they tend to represent not the farmers and the debtors, but they represent the silver mining interests, which also happen to be in the western states. So the same places where south and the west for Bryan, but the silver Republicans are from the western states. So it isn't quite a straightforward question of like saying that the people are on the side of silver. So I think that William Randolph Hearst, the character in Citizen Kane, like, is based on, he comes from like a silver mining family.
When the gold standard then gets enacted as the basis of international trade and international finance, it's complicated, as you've just described. It's not simply straightforwardly, if you're on the side of gold, you're a creditor. If you're on the side of silver, you're a debtor, whatever it is, the people versus the elites. Nonetheless, the people who were the advocates of the gold standard believed it produced not just security and predictability, but also it was a kind of self-correcting system in a way, that because there was a relatively fixed amount of gold in the world, trade imbalances would correct themselves over time. Gold would flow in and flow out of countries. And because there was this international currency, it meant that overall, in the end, these big sort of swings in trade would iron themselves out. So you wouldn't get that kind of boom-bust cycle, which is, you know, the fear of a lot of international finance. Did it work? I mean, did it work before it stopped working, which we're going to come on to, and it did stop working, we have to be clear. In its heyday, did it work? Did anchoring this on gold mean that international trade was not just predictable, but it was also self-correcting?
I don't think it was self-correcting, no. I mean, I think that the system only worked by central banks cooperating with each other, and that really meant the banks at the centre of the system around the Bank of England. And one reason why that was more difficult in the United States in that period that leads to the populist revolt is because at that point the United States doesn't have a central bank. The Federal Reserve is not created until 1913. I think it's a situation where the economic outcomes pull in two radically different directions. On the one hand, if you look at the period from 1870 to 1914 to the outbreak of the First World War, this is a period in which there was a huge amount of international trade and a large amount of foreign investment. And that was the case on the trade side, despite the fact that most countries, i.e. pretty much most everybody except for Britain, were at least from the 1890s pursuing protectionist policies. Certainly the United States was, but Germany to some extent as well. So you have a proliferation of international trade at the same time as tariffs are going up. So something is making it possible for that trade to expand and the volume in which it was doing. And you can say, well, maybe it was the international financial system that was doing that. On the other hand, when you look at the difficulties that states had adjusting to the system in which there was only gold underpinning money, almost all of them found it incredibly difficult. If you go back to Britain, so 50 years before this, so when Britain restored gold convertibility after the Napoleonic Wars done by the Lord Liverpool's government, you know, it caused a deep depression because prices fell so much. They'd risen during wartime, and then to restore convertibility, they had to come down. That's the context in which you get the reform politics of the 1820s leading up to the 1832 Reform Act in Britain, the context of the Peterloo Massacre. If you take the case of Germany, which is a crucial turning point in terms of European countries moving on to the gold standard, that was the response of Bismarck to Prussia, now Germany's victory in the Franco-Prussian War. In Germany's case, ending silver, and Germany had been a silver country and not a bimetallic, or the German states, I should say, had been a silver country and not a bimetallic currency, was made much easier by the fact that the reparations that were demanded from France to end the occupation of Paris could then be used to establish gold as the currency. So it had a supply of gold by basically telling the French they had to pay for it, and they were paying for it until the German troops left. But even in Germany, by the end of the 1870s, certainly by the early 1880s, there's considerable political opposition to this, because what people can see is the effect of having gold is being to push prices down, to create deflation, to create these really hard economic conditions. Now, you might then say the response to that in Germany in particular is more protectionist from the 1880s onwards, including protecting agricultural production. That is a lot trickier, I think, on the US side, which is why I think that the US case is where the contested politics of it runs for so long, really all the way from 1873, the crime of 1873 as it's called, to the 1896 election. And even then, I'd say it's really made easier after the 1896 election, after this period of depression, because there's some more gold discoveries. But there's also, it's almost, I was thinking this morning, it's almost like the equivalent of fracking for shale oil and gas in the 1890s, a new way of extracting gold from imperfect ore, better technology for doing it, so you get a bigger supply. And so the first decade of the 20th century is not as hard as the 1890s. Now, in a way, then, I would draw the conclusion from all this, though it's hard to draw really clear conclusions, that the system really wasn't particularly stable unless the central banks were really working together at moments of crisis in order to stop or to make it much harder for a government to say, at that moment of political crisis that we're facing, all this domestic opposition that we're pulling out. That's what doesn't happen.
So one of the ways in which this might therefore be a bad idea or an idea that doesn't really make sense is that there is a real contradiction between the pitch of the gold standard, the advocates of the gold standard, which is it introduces, okay, if not a self-correcting system, a stable system, a reliable system, and the appeal of gold, the allure of gold, the thing that you can't produce by alchemy, is that it is relatively immune to human interference. And basing money on gold, part of the appeal of that is that it's harder for politicians to tinker with it, to inflate it, to print more of it, whatever it is. At the same time, the system completely depends on politicians being willing to act to back it up and to support it. And actually, when you look at the history of the system, both when it works and when it breaks down, it doesn't work and break down because of some inherent quality of gold. It works and it breaks down because politicians do or don't act in a way to support the system. So if this is the system that's meant to, and I think this was part of the appeal, particularly in an increasingly democratic age, you know, the fear that the people would demand more money, inflation, inflate away their debt, the timeless fear of democracy, gold is a protection against that, sort of bulwark against the people. And yet, the gold standard entirely depends on politicians and bankers and the relationship between politicians and bankers acting to defend it. So it's not a system that's somehow above or beyond or outside of political interference. It's just another system that depends on political interference. Wasn't that its problem?
Well, I think that you have to draw a line here between what happened before the First World War and what happened when the gold standard was resurrected in the 1920s. Because I'm not sure how much direct political interference, and I mean by that from politicians, elected politicians, that there is in the period from the 1870s to the 1914. There's a lot of contest in a number of countries' electoral politics about the monetary system, obviously, particularly in the United States. But in terms of the actual operation of the system, who is rescuing it at the moments of crisis is the central banks, and particularly it's the Bank of England. And it usually has to work with other central banks in order to do that. I mean, the biggest threat probably that the Bank of England faced was the Barings crisis in 1890. And it was very much the bank having to sort out what to do about that rather than the government at the time. I think that what happens, this is really, I think, central to the breakdown in the early 1930s of the revised gold standard. So the one that was put back together after the First World War was that politicians, elected politicians, were much less willing to just say central bank can get on with whatever is needs to do in order to make this system work, whether it's acting as a lender of last resort to Barings, whether it's setting monetary policy to deal with gold movements or currency, foreign exchange reserve movements.
And by implication, therefore allowing unemployment to rise or whatever it is, or producing deflationary effects or squeezing the money supply, all the things that can provoke furious political reaction. Politicians weren't any more willing to say, that's not our business, that's the business of the central bank.
No, there's a quotation from one of the Treasury officials, I think, from the sometime said in the 1920s, where he said, look, the politicians and us, in a way, at the Treasury would have cared as much about what rate the bank set as the interest rate before 1914 as it would the colour that they painted the door of Threadneedle Street, which is where the Bank of England is. You go to like 1925, 1926 Britain, and Churchill is sitting up at, you know, in the middle of the night with his whiskey, writing these extraordinarily pained memos about the bank's monetary policy. And he's in agony over it. He understands that he's not going to get to make the decision that the Bank of England's going to make the decision. But if you want to say, when does, in the British case, the monetary environment completely change, it would be the moment in 1932 when the politicians say, actually, the Treasury, i.e. the government, is going to set interest rates and not the Bank of England. And that comes a year after Britain has left the gold standard. But I think that there's no doubt that in that atmosphere of late 1920s politics, early 1930s, after the stock market crash, that gold becomes a symbolic question of how much anybody thinks that a radical politics is a good thing or a bad thing. So if you go to America again, 1933, Roosevelt's election, and Roosevelt, within a month of taking office, would have taken the United States off the gold standard and actually effectively prohibited it. Anybody in the United States to hold gold as coinage. He did that by executive order in April 1933. The critics are like, this is mob rule. This is like the equivalent of like the French Revolution. So by this point, it's been highly, highly politicized. And I think this is the point when that story that you were telling about gold being this uniquely reliable, anti-democratic thing in some sense, that's the point when that appears. I think that prior to the First World War, it's more, in a sense, geopolitical than that, in the sense that gold is seen as the standard of civilization. And so the Chinese are considered outside civilization. They stick with silver. Imperial China sticks with silver all the way to the end. And Republican China, actually, until some point in the 1930s, sticks with it too.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Okay, I think we need to sort of separate out the different points at which this thing breaks down. And there is a question here about whether we are talking about an idea or a system. So there are beliefs attached to it. There are superstitions attached to it. Gold produces superstitions. People worship it. You know, it looks nice. There is a limited amount of it in the world, but as you say, it fluctuates. And gold and silver, it's not straightforwardly that gold is more secure because there's just less of it. But at the various points where this system breaks down, so it breaks down in 1914, it's resurrected, then it breaks down again in the early 1930s with chaotic consequences. A version of it is resurrected after the Second World War, and then that breaks down again in the early 1970s. So we've got 3 points at which it breaks down. So you're going to have to correct me if I get this wrong, but it seems to me in 1914 it breaks down, not because of popular pressure or democratic politics, but because the outbreak of the First World War is an event that requires incredibly rapid action on a whole number of fronts. And the system is too slow for that. I mean, the point of the gold standard, in a way, is it's meant to slow things down a bit to prevent sort of precipitate action. But precipitate action was required in August 1914, and the system was just not adaptable enough. In the 1930s, it breaks down, as you've described, partly under political pressure. You know, the politicians can't just sit back and let the system do its work. There's a kind of different kind of urgency to it. And then we'll come on to what happens in the early 1970s. But it has this kind of range of problems with it. It's simultaneously, it's not adaptable enough when you need to adapt. It produces political instability when it's meant to be the system that generates long-term stability. And then, as we see in the early 1970s, actually the other reason it breaks down is that it prioritizes one country or one country's central bank. It was the Bank of England in the early 20th century. By the 60s and 70s, it's the United States of America and the Federal Reserve. And so it becomes symbolically associated with the power of a single nation, and reaction against that produces a kind of geopolitical instability. It's got lots of problems with it for something that is held up as the thing that will be the anchor of trade and prosperity and security if you just are patient enough to let gold work its magic. That's my argument against the gold standard.
I'm not really sure that anybody believes it's working magic as such. I think, in a way, the point where I might disagree with you is the 1914 one, because I'm not sure that the problem is with the gold standard in 1914. The problem is that the gold standard requires peace.
Right. Well, that's a problem with it then, because there is no such thing as perpetual peace.
No, but you've then got to say, well, what's the alternative to a financial system, an international financial system that facilitates international trade? And I think probably that it's incredibly difficult to have one that's going to be any kind of system that's going to be war-proof. So, you know, the alternatives are that you could have what went before it, way before it, the silver version of international trade. The silver is not really a standard, but it's a silver-based international trade. You could have bimetallism as the alternative, or you could have a fiat currency.
And just to be clear, fiat currency is where the government sets the value of the money.
Yeah, where basically, yeah, there is no metal basis for the currency. And I think that I wouldn't really be confident, I'm thinking out loud here, but I wouldn't really be confident of saying that if you'd had either silver or any of silver bimetallism or fiat in August 1914, that the international financial system would have been able to cope.
So in that case, the bad idea was the First World War, not the gold standard. I think, and probably the First World War was, in the long run, a bad idea. Okay, then what about the early 1970s? So we have moved since the early 1970s, since the presidency of Richard Nixon, the first term of Richard Nixon's presidency, to a system which is basically a fiat money system. So the gold standard, which operates not in its classic form, but in a modified form during what's called the Bretton Woods era, so the post-Second World War era, it's anchored to the dollar, and the dollar is anchored to gold, the international trading system. And in 1971, that breaks down. So now, ever since, effectively, we've been living in an age of fiat money. Is that breakdown evidence that it was a bad idea? Is that breakdown an accident? Is that breakdown a political decision that could have gone the other way? Had the gold standard in this form simply reached the end of the road? Or are these things much more contingent than that? Because there are people who regret it, right? They regret the end of Bretton Woods.
They do. I mean, I think that this raises a host of questions, David. I mean, the first of them I like is whether we can describe the Bretton Woods system as any kind of continuity of the gold standard. Because the only thing that is left of the old system is the fact that the American dollar is convertible for foreign governments or sort of foreign central banks for $35 an ounce. It's not convertible for Americans at that rate. And no other currencies convertible have got a fixed convertibility rate into gold. So in lots of ways, you could say that the Bretton Woods system is a dollar standard, just holding on, in a sense, to the idea that we don't yet want to move into that world where there's nothing metallic or commodity of any kind underneath the money that's moving around the world economy. And in that sense, it's a little bit of caution, perhaps, of like saying...
Or superstition. I mean, what happens if you take gold out from that system? Does it change?
Well, the interesting thing here is that if you look at the period like from August 1971 to March 1973... you still have the fixed exchange rate system part of Bretton Woods, which most people would say is the centerpiece of Bretton Woods, and there's no longer gold convertibility.
So the fixed exchange rate system is that currencies don't float against each other. There is an agreement as to what their value is.
And now you could say, well, that didn't last very long. You know, it lasts about 18 months. But that was the first attempt that was made to kind of preserve an international monetary system on a multilateral basis without gold. So that's one thing. The second thing is then you've got to say, well, why was it the case that Nixon decided to end the system as it was based on dollar gold convertibility? And, you know, the simple answer is that he wasn't willing for the American economy and his own political prospects to pay the price that was necessary for maintaining the system. So faced with a choice between his domestic political purposes and economic growth in the United States and the system, the international system, he chose the domestic over the international. And if you stand back and then say, well, how had it got to the position where the United States couldn't defend dollar gold convertibility any longer? I think there are two answers, and they have different implications, I think. I think the first of them is that the system as it was conceived at Bretton Woods in 1944 rested on the premise that the United States was going to have effectively a permanent trade surplus in the post-war world. And that wasn't the case by the early 1970s. And crucially, it wasn't the case because the United States was on a very rapid trajectory by 1971 to be becoming the largest oil importer in the world. So you could then say that actually there was another premise underpinning that currency system from 1944, which was domestic American oil. The second thing, though, is that from the middle of the 1950s, certainly through like the 1960s, you've got the growth of this euro-dollar system, which is effectively another currency of dollars that's circulating around the world economy that's backed neither by gold nor by the Federal Reserve. It's not a fiat currency. It's a currency that's being created by banks, effectively. And that currency, euro-dollars, made it incredibly difficult for the system to work. So in that sense, you might say that the Bretton Woods version of the gold standard was overwhelmed by factors that don't feature in either the late 19th century or the first half of the 20th century.
And if you then compare, this is a big question, and I know you're going to say it's more complicated than this, but if you compare the fiat money period to the variants of the gold standard that preceded it. So Bretton Woods is maybe a very tenuous version of it, or even a superstitious version of it. You have the more classical version at the end of the 19th century. You have the resuscitated version in the 1920s, which just doesn't work because it cannot accommodate the political pressures that underpin it. If you compare those two periods, there are people now who are nostalgic for the gold standard, and they think what we've had since the 1970s is inflation, a lot of it at various points. We've had economic crises. We've had trade crises. You know, we've had developing nation or emerging nation crises, massive inflows and outflows of capital, not disciplined by anything. At the same time, the period since the early 1970s has been a period of global growth and globalization and, you know, an incredibly complex trading system that has survived that period. Does it look with hindsight that the fear of fiat money that the advocates of the gold standard would have said was a real fear? You know, if you take gold out from under this thing, it will eventually unravel, that fear was overblown relative to what the fiat money people would say about the gold standard, which is if you keep anchoring this thing on gold, it will unravel because it will not be able to accommodate the pressures that it faces. How do you weigh the two against each other?
I mean, I think it's really difficult to see how a world economy that was made up of states that were obsessed with growth in different ways, and that was true whether they were liberal democracies or whether they were communist states, was really going to hold on to any system in which that growth would be constrained by metals. And I think that there is something quite deep about that, in a sense. But I think as well that the people who don't like fiat money, I'm not particularly sympathetic to them about the gold itself question. And I think that since 1971, gold has been fetishized, and particularly by anti-inflationary hawks who are willing to attribute all kinds of ills that, in my view, have got some other explanations to monetary-driven inflation.
And in their own minds, the pressures of a certain kind of democratic politics. They want to take money out of the hands of the people, as people like that have always wanted to do.
I think, though, that if you stand back a bit and think about it a little bit more widely, maybe it's not quite the right word, but it will do for now, and say, has it been a really good idea to develop a worldwide economic system that is entirely, in monetary terms, detached from any sense of the physical world? I'm not so sure. In the sense that I think actually that perhaps at least symbolically, psychologically, I'm not sure what level I quite mean here, that a world in which there was some kind of resource constraint on the economy had got something to say for it in the world in which we now live, in which we can see just how at times devastating the consequences of economic growth can be in a planetary sense. Now, that isn't to give a gold, you know, hawk answer to that question. I just think that whether the system that we have now created and everything that comes with it is sustainable or not is a very, very big and important question.
What I take from that, I mean, it's a fascinating and sort of terrifying thought in a way. What I take from that is that the heyday of the gold standard, where there weren't those kinds of constraints, not the kind that we see now at the beginning, well, not at the beginning of the 21st century, we're well into the 21st century. The gold standard in its heyday was there to anchor a system that probably didn't necessarily need that kind of constraint. And if there was a constraint, the constraint one would hope would be against war, which was, you know, part of the point of globalization for people who believe in it has always been if you really get these states kind of linked together in various ways, it'll be much less likely that they'll go to war. And that turns out not to be true. So the gold standard didn't hold states together in a system that made war less likely because war came. And the gold standard was there to constrain, among other things, a fear of democracy. Now, when there really are those constraints, it feels impossible that we would ever go back to it. I mean, I'm finding myself thinking that you might say there are circumstances in which anchoring money on something in the physical world is a good idea. And one of those times might be now, but it's too late. I mean, what would we anchor it on if it's not gold?
Well, you can anchor it on, obviously, on another metal. I mean, it doesn't have to be gold.
But we're not going to go back to a metallic system, are we? And it's not going to be cryptocurrency because that's not stable.
This is quite speculative. This is where the 70s, I think, is such a crucial decade. Because if you think about it as the story of how the dollar has remained the dominant currency in international trade since the breakdown of the dollar's privileged relationship with gold is you could say that the answer is that actually Middle Eastern oil became the basis of the dollar system. And that why did everyone keep wanting to use dollars anyway, even when they weren't substitutable into gold, convertible into gold any longer? I think part of the answer is because the dollar remained the currency in which oil, the most important energy source, had to be bought. But I also think that's only partially the answer, because the other reason it did was because of this euro-dollar system going on at the same time and all these dollars outside the United States that would be created by banks. And that's a system that kind of comes crashing down in the 2008 crash. So we're living in that sense, I think, still with a parallel or dual international financial system, one around the banks and one around the dollar in a more conventional sense. And what we're then seeing is the fact that, let's call them the revisionist states, China, Russia, Iran in particular, are quite keen on gold over the dollar. They're trying to construct some of their monetary financial relations with each other, trade relations even to some extent, on the basis of gold. Now, I don't think that they're going to be particularly successful at that, not least because of the way in which the dollar entirely dominates on the banking side of things. But that's also the reason why they want to escape into gold, away from the dollar, because the dollar as it works now is the basis in which the United States can use these financial sanctions and make it incredibly difficult for states with which it has confrontational relations. So if you look at like where the challenge, the overt challenge to the dollar system is coming from, it's coming from governments that do want to use gold as the means of pursuing that financial confrontation. As I say, I don't think they'll be particularly successful, but the impulse to gold there hasn't gone away.
So the irony of that is almost that gold, it's not the currency or the money of kings anymore, but it is the currency or money of autocrats or of more authoritarian regimes. And it's not that silver is the currency of the people, but the dollar is the currency of at least democratic regimes, and that the contest that we're seeing now is a familiar one between gold and an alternative to gold, one of which speaks to a certain kind of political elite and another of which speaks to, I don't want to say the democratic people, it's a different political elite, but it's a different kind of system. But that also then begs another question, which is the last question I want to ask you, which is the way in which the democratic states have coped since the financial crisis is certainly not to go back to gold, but to produce more money, quantitative easing. And so we're now in a world post 2008. So there's a period from 1973 to 2008, a dollar period. We're still in a dollar world, but we're also in a quantitative easing world in which central banks have broken many of their own rules about what's possible. And we're in a world, you've written about this a lot, where the old rules don't apply anymore. So if I had to ask you, this is a completely unfair question, but if I had to ask you which is the worst idea, if you had to choose in the world that we're in now, some iteration of the gold standard, even if it's not necessarily gold, or a world of quantitative easing, which is the worst idea, the gold standard or quantitative easing?
Well, I'm not going to answer the question, I'm afraid, that directly. But in the world in which we live, and everything that happened can't be undone, then quantitative easing was a necessary response, I think, to what happened in 2008.
And it wouldn't have been possible in a gold standard world. So you could say, thank God we weren't on the gold standard. But
the thing, though, that a bit that misses is that 2008 is I think, ultimately a crisis of like the euro-dollar system. And so the idea or the practice that banks could create these dollars backed by, as I say, neither metal nor a state is what led us into the problems of 2008. And then to which quantitative easing became, at least in the short term, a necessary response.
So could you say of quantitative easing, at least it's backed by states?
Well, it's backed by central banks. It's, I would say, got long-term uncertain consequences. We still, I don't think, know that what we've done in this respect. And this is where I think that the earlier history is really interesting, because it's actually, despite the fact that you often like read, oh, this is the first time that the world's used fiat money, but actually Imperial China used fiat money for like a long time. And then the system broke down. And that's what then why they wanted all this silver. And then we're at the beginning of the story that by the 1870s is all the systems like break down. So then the question will become, if it's all some version of it's all happened before, it all happened again. I know that's some odds with what I've just said as well. Is the question would be, well, and I just think you can't answer that question, is like, well, what happens when quantitative easing system breaks down? And I don't know what the answer is.
You can hear much more of Helen Thompson on her excellent weekly podcast, These Times, which discusses geopolitics in all its different form. If you'd like to hear an ad-free version of this podcast and to get the bonus episodes that are going to accompany this series and the two that are out now for our series on the history of freedom with Leah Rippey, subscribe to PPF Plus by going to ppfideas.com or just follow the link that comes with the show description. Do also follow us on Twitter at PPF Ideas to find out more about what's coming up on this series. The next bad idea we're discussing is with the writer and philosopher Kathleen Stock, and I'm going to be talking to her about Facebook friends. It sounds like an innocuous idea. It sounds like quite a nice idea. It's really not. Listen next time to find out why. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.